99 out of 100 times that animal is going to stop on their own, but they're going to stop relaxed. They're going to stop oblivious to you even being there. And they're going to be looking around. They're going to be distracted. They're not going to be looking for you. It gives you plenty of time to shoot. And most of the time when you shoot, they're going to stand like a stone and just eat that arrow.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff, and no BS, this show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. Why is it when you're in the elk woods that you call it a bull? Sometimes he comes charging in, sometimes he ignores you altogether, and other times he turns and heads in the other direction. Was it just that you were a bad caller? Did you really just not sound good? Or maybe you said the wrong thing to that elk? I mean, elk certainly have to have a language. There has to be some meaning behind the different elk vocalizations. Our guest tonight is Chris Rowe, and he's a wildlife biologist that has studied elk for decades. He helps us break down the language of elk, and not only how to sound good, but more importantly, what to say in certain situations. I think there's a lot of value in the information that Chris has to share with us tonight, and I'm excited for you guys to hear it. Before we dive into the show with Chris, want to thank Zach Lundy for the review in iTunes. Zach, we want to send you some Exo Mountain Gear swag, so please send us your shipping information to podcast@exomountaingear.com. Listeners, if you want to be entered into these giveaways, it's really simple. We just want to hear from you. If you can leave us a review in iTunes or Stitcher, wherever else you're listening to this, that'd be great. You can also contact us directly to podcast@exomountaingear.com with any questions, comments, or feedback. All right, let's dive into the show with Chris Rowe from Rowe Hunting Resources. Chris, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we just, we're talking for almost 15 minutes. I thought we better just hit record before we talk for an hour and then forget to actually do a podcast here. Once you get talking hunting, it's easy to let the time go.
Exactly. And I'm not usually one of few words anyway. So.
Well, good. I'm glad you have a lot to share. We're excited to hear it. This is overdue to get you on the show. We're really excited to do it. We've had listeners of our show request to get you on, so we're finally getting that done. Great time of year to do it, preseason here. But to start with, maybe for some listeners who are not familiar with you or with the resources that you have out there in terms of elk hunting, just go ahead and give us an intro, give us a background. It'd be great.
Yeah, sure. So like you said, if you're not familiar with who I am, a wildlife biologist specializing in more behavioral ecology. Did a lot of range management type stuff and remote sensing sort of stuff when I got out of college. But really my passion has always been animal behavior and using that information in a management context. So for our professional business, we kind of have two sides of our business. Both my wife and I are wildlife biologists. We operate in the private sector. We have a consulting company, Rowe Ecological Services, where we do your typical bird and bunny surveys. We do clearances for development or management planning for municipalities or county governments. We do everything that you can imagine for wildlife biology and wildlife management planning for development, energy, whether it's energy development or roads, highways, you know, residential or, you know, commercial, it doesn't matter. So we do all that, and Kelly, my wife, handles the bulk of that side of everything. And then everything that I do from a land management perspective with regard to hunting and our guiding and all of our educational materials that I do, I run through Rowe Hunting Resources, and I kind of head that up. Now, Kelly is, in like most of our wives, is absolutely incredible. She's also got a law degree And she also does all of our website stuff. So she's an amazing internet development type person, and she does all our website management. So yeah, without her, this the role hunting resources side, especially the online educational materials, probably wouldn't exist. So yeah, she's awesome. So we started most of our the ecological services side in the early 2000s. I had been in hunting and fishing all my life, but as I was wrapping up my undergraduate career, you know, being a cocky kid that thought he knew everything, there was an opportunity to get involved with Primos Hunting Calls from the standpoint of being on their pro staff. That's when pro staff actually was like pro staff. So,
a couple of photos and followers out there.
Yeah, we were the people that literally went to the trade shows. We were the folks that went and did the seminars and tested the products. And I mean, it was fun. It was daunting, but it was fun.
And actual work too.
Oh yeah. No, I was on the, in the summer I was on the road constantly. There was a couple summers in a row where from June 1st till about that last week of August, I was on the road every weekend. Every Friday night, Saturday night, and even some Sunday afternoons. And there was occasional where I'd do Thursday nights. Every week I was on the road going somewhere, doing another seminar, doing another clinic, doing something. It was just nonstop. It was craziness. But growing up hunting, I had some uncles and family members that got me into hunting, but we were all kind of DIY. We were all self-taught. We didn't have these wise mentors, if you will. My grandfather kind of gave me some really good, initial tips on turkey hunting and turkey calling and fly fishing and that. But for the most part, we just kind of were self-taught. And so when we were growing up going to seminars, you'd go to some seminars, and I'm sure probably some people listen to this now are probably the same way. You go to a seminar and you sit there for an hour and you're like, goodness gracious, why am I sitting here? What am I getting out of this? I don't want to hear your stories about how you've gone to this place or that place or this place or that place. Give me some meat and potatoes. I'm giving you my time to sit here and learn something. Teach me something. I used to call it the so what factor. So what? Why am I sitting in this chair listening to you? So what? So all of a sudden now I'm the Primos guy. I'm the guy doing the seminars. So it's like, yeah, so what? Now people are listening to me.
Yeah.
So I better have something of substance. And so, beyond your typical, this is how you run an elk mouth, mouth diaphragm, this is how you run a bugle or whatever, I started incorporating my behavioral ecology and biology stuff that I've done and the research that I'd done with elk into those the discussions in the seminars. And people loved it. And so I just continued. We kept growing and growing and growing. I started doing summer clinics, 3-day clinics and the whole nine yards. And then finally in about 2010, that's when the internet really kind of caught up to where it made from a DIY standpoint, where Kelly could actually get online and actually manipulate websites. And we had online streaming was starting, and we had the ability to bring that material to a marketplace type setting in a very easy medium for us to manipulate it, but also to bring very high quality material for people to watch. Because the one thing that I truly believe in is, anybody can flap their gums at you. I can sit there and talk at you. You can sit there and talk to people. But when we're talking about vocalizations, communication, behavior, and we're talking about behavioral ecology and those type of principles, the best teacher is to sit there and literally watch the animals do it themselves so you can see it. So that's always been kind of the foundation for what we've wanted to bring with the Roe Hunting Resources educational materials online. I'm going to tell you that an elk is going to do XYZ, but rather than just tell you about it, I'm going to show you HD video and now 4K video. Here's an elk doing it. Here's she doing this, or here's he doing that, or you can watch this bull bugle. You can listen to a bugle. You can watch his body language. Now you get to see who reacts, why they react. Did they react? Did they not react? What about the cows? You get the entire context, and then we can go through that and pick it all apart and just help people really get a concrete understanding of what's going on out there, why. And again, my philosophy is understanding why they're doing it, and then how that can translate in, for this case, a hunting scenario. You know, in from a land manager's standpoint, I can sit there and say, okay, if we're going to manage this property for elk, sure, there's some behavioral stuff that we want to do from a land management side. But from a hunting side, that's where the row hunting resources, we've got an elk module, a turkey module, and we're going to be really diving into our whitetail module here in the future.
That's awesome. Before we get into, I guess, some of the vocalizations and calling specifically, I'd love to hear about some examples of this behavioral aspects from your background that, you know, most hunters miss out on simply because they don't have the education or don't have the experience or don't have the time in the field like you have. Just kind of give us an idea of what are some of these behaviors other than the standard stuff that we're familiar with hearing, you know, whether a bull's being dominant, whether a bull's challenging, things like that, you know, the common talk of behavior. But I'm just interested from your perspective, what are some things you can kind of give us to look out for in the field, maybe kind of open our eyes as to what's happening at a deeper level than what we currently understand as your average hunter?
Well, right off the bat, you know, we separate everything out on our website, you know, because in different blocks of information. So from the foundation principles, just the basic foundation understanding, your basic behavior, like one of the biggest things is what I call the doorway principle, or and especially the see you first, hear you second principle. You know, the doorway, you know, everybody talks about calling and being a better caller, but and I do too. But I think anybody would admit that really it doesn't matter how good of a caller you are. If you don't have your setup right, it can be almost irrelevant at times, because if you get your setup wrong, it doesn't matter if that animal responds to you and starts to come in. If he doesn't give you a shot opportunity, or based on how you're calling or what you're doing or where you set up, the animal swings around downwind, it's over before it even began.
Yeah. So setup in terms of positioning.
Positioning on the landscape. But the thing is most folks will spend a lot of time talking about, okay, set up where you've got a shooting lane, or set up where you've got stuff behind you to break up your outline and all that. And all that's extremely important. But especially nowadays, and we can have an argument or a discussion on whether camouflage matters or doesn't matter or what. But especially nowadays with quality camouflage patterns, I mean, goodness gracious, some of these, and I've tested it and I can show it repeatedly on our videos, where you can stand in the middle of a wide open, you know, forest or on the edge of a meadow and wide open, and your camouflage will work extremely well. But did you choose the spot on that landscape in that particular area to maximize your success of getting an animal in front of you? And if you look at the doorway principle, I talk about, you know, how does it, we always look at it from our perspective. All right. So with bull bugles up the hill, we cover the distance. He's responding. We get within 100 yards. The bull's, he's coming. He's moving in. The first thing that a lot of us are going to do is we're going to stop and we're going to be like, all right, where are the shooting lanes? Where can I hide? You know, where can I get my camouflage pattern blended in the best? Do I stand up? Do I kneel or whatever? And then if we think about where the elk is going to come from, it's usually secondary. Where what I spend a lot of time talking about is, okay, how do we flip that around? I don't care so much about what's behind me or around me. I'm going to let my camouflage do the work. I'm going to be careful on what camouflage I choose. I'm going to let that do the work. If it's doing its work, I don't need to worry about it. So I don't. And then from a standpoint of shooting lanes, I'm going to choose those shooting lanes that are going to put me in front of the place where that animal is going to naturally stop on the landscape by themselves. And they will. We all, and it's not rocket science. That's the thing, is a lot of the stuff that I talk about is not, some of it is, you know, I don't want to say ground, but anyway, some of it is unique, I should say, but other stuff is not. And so like this, you know, people talk about all the time, well, the bull came in, but then he hung up at 80 yards. I'll guarantee you 99 times out of 10, 99 out of 100, the bull hung out because he stopped in what I call that doorway, the natural area where those animals are going to move across their landscape, and they're going to expect to be able to visually engage whoever they're hearing. You know, animals are moving across their house, just like we move across our house. And I give this example all the time. If our wives or our girlfriends or boyfriends or whatever, significant other, our kids call to, if we're in the living room sitting watching TV and someone calls to us from the back bedroom, we don't go to the garage looking for them, again, unless we're trying to avoid them, right? So we know our house. And when someone vocalizes from a different area of our house, we know where that is. We know it's in the back bedroom, and we know that if we get out of our chair, we go around the corner, up the stairs, down the hall, turn the corner, and we go to bedroom number two, that that is where that individual is vocalizing from. But here's the question. Do we march right into that bedroom and walk straight up to the individual and stand right by them and then ask what, or, you know, okay, what do you need? Or, you know, do we ask for clarification? Or do we get out of our chair, travel all that way, and then pause, whether it's slightly, whether it's subconsciously, it doesn't matter. Do we pause in that doorway of that room and initially search for visual confirmation of where that person is? It might take us a millisecond, but if you think about it, we do that. We'll get to that doorway. We will pause. We will look. If the person is in sight, our brain can instantly, we see them, we see what's going on. And if it's, you know, say they're trying to move a dresser, we don't need to ask what's going on. Boom, we see you, we see what's going on. I know what I need to do. And we just continue to move in. Whereas if we walk in, we know that they call from that back bedroom and we get to the doorway, we take a couple steps inside, what do we normally do? Most of us are going to probably pause. And then we're going to vocalize, hey, where are you? Oh, I'm in the closet. Okay, now I need to move forward again. I get to the door with the closet. I pause and I look. We want to make visual contact with the person that's talking to us. Elk are no different. And so if they're in their bedroom, bedding area, and we're calling to them from their, you know, kitchen or dining room, that feeding, that meadow or wherever they're feeding, or we're traveling down that hallway, there, you know, the travel corridor headed between these, you know, if we are in their house and we're vocalizing, they know where we are. And because they know where we are, and based on whatever they're hearing us say, whether we're bugling, whether we're cow calling or how we're cow calling, based on what they hear, based on where they hear it, it instantly puts an image in their brain and they know what to expect and why it's occurring. And if they're going to respond, we have to understand they're going to travel across their house exactly like we travel across our house. They are going to pause in their doorways, those transitions from, you know, the thicker cover of their bedding area to the open, you know, edge of the aspens, or from the aspens out to that meadow. They're going to go from the thicker timber into the more open timber. Anywhere you've got that, you know, whether it's a vegetation density break, going from dense to thin or thin to dense, or maybe you've got a bench or you've got a saddle or there's a train break, whatever. As soon as they get to that point where they should be able to make visual eye contact with whoever they're hearing into that particular area, they're going to pause. And the beautiful thing about that is, okay, if you know that, one of the other things that people run into all the time, the animal's moving in, say it does not hang up and it keeps on coming, but it's going to go right on by them. Maybe someone gives them a cow call to stop them, or they use their voice to stop them, or they give them a chuckle or something to stop them, and that animal stops. Well, depending on how you stopped them and how close they are, a lot of times those elk are going to whip their head over. They're going to stop on a dime. You're going to watch their body coil. They're going to look in your direction, and they're going to be staring a hole through you because, oh, what the heck was that? Depending on the distance, you take, especially with a bow, you take a shot. There are a lot of times people say, well, that bull reacted and he kind of spun and maybe I hit him in the shoulder, or he spun and I hit him far back, or he spun and he dropped. I've had it happen. I've seen it happen with hunters of mine. that animal can literally absolutely jump the string just like a whitetail and have that arrow go right over their back. If you set up with doorway in your mind, 99 out of 100 times that animal is going to stop on their own, but they're going to stop relaxed. They're going to stop oblivious to you even being there, and they're going to be looking around. They're going to be distracted. They're not going to be looking for you. It gives you plenty of time to shoot, and most of the time when you shoot, they're going to stand like a stone and just eat that arrow.
So a key takeaway, that makes so much sense and an incredibly helpful way to break it down. As a key takeaway from that to then make your approach and sort of beat them to these transitions areas, beat them to these doorways, try and identify the point of these transitions between you and the elk, beat them there and have a setup at those locations.
Absolutely. And this is the other thing too. And this is, I think, an important distinction for what I talk about and my philosophy. I hunt solo. Now, granted, I'm taking some relatives hunting for their first elk hunt this year, and every now and then I will go with friends of mine. But for my personal elk hunts, almost every single time, I am by myself, solo. So I don't have the benefit of a shooter-caller type scenario. No one's calling for me. I'm not up front of anybody. When I vocalize, I need to put that animal in front of me within my effective yardage. And so, you know, my tagline, you know, call them to your toes. I like close encounters. The farthest elk I've ever killed is 33 yards. The last three elk I've killed are 13 to 14 yards. I enjoy the game of manipulating what they see, hear, and believe and putting them right smack in front of me. So, yes, the doorway principle for me is absolutely critical. But you got to keep in mind, I mean, there's so many, and I show this on a lot of the videos we do, there's so many little places. I mean, sometimes all you need to do is put a big thick patch of brush behind you or next to you, or, you know, between or on the other side of where you are and where the elk is coming from. So that way, you know, if you think about an elk, maybe it's a cow elk. If you're cow calling and you're portraying yourself to be a cow and maybe a calf, well, you could have a thick chunk of oak brush, or you could have a thick bunch of service berry or young aspens or young pines in some of the, you know, regen areas. You could have a thick bunch of crud that you could put behind you. Well, there could be a cow and a calf on the back side of that animal can't see. It might be a wide open meadow, but they can't see on the other side of that. Well, they're going to have to move forward and get themselves to a spot where they can look around it. Well, again, wherever that spot is where they can finally look around that backside, that's going to be the doorway. Well, depending on how you set up on the landscape, you can manipulate where those animals are going to stand in front of you extremely, extremely well. It takes practice. I help people identify it, but I mean, it takes practice. But my gosh, when you start doing that, it is amazing, and it doesn't matter. See, that's a beautiful thing. If you're a solo hunter, it works great. But the same thing goes. If you're a two-person or a three-person caller type setup, you got a caller or two behind the shooter, you put that shooter in the doorway, and then you get the caller's – it's over. It's done, because that animal's going to pause in the doorway, and then it's going to continue on through. So not only do you have a shot opportunity when they pause in the doorway, but you have a shot opportunity as they pass by you.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly how I killed my bull last year.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And again, from a standpoint of, you know, it doesn't seem like rocket science. It's really not. But some of the stuff that I talk about is just a different way of looking things. You know what I mean? If you just kind of turn it around and, you know, again, if you want to talk about vocalizations, you know, a lot of people are out there, and you sent this in my email, kind of a couple little, you know, we're asking a couple little questions. You know, one of the things I see people all the time, from me, my standpoint, I see it as a mistake. In many cases, you know, you hear people all the time talk about chirps and mews, chirps and mews, chirps and mews. I'm gonna sound like a bunch of elk, and I wanna use a bunch of chirps and mews. Okay, well, that's fine. You can do that. But the problem is you'll hear people talk about, well, I was calling, and I knew the animals were there, but they never responded to me, or I didn't get a response. They didn't do anything. Well, it's because you didn't ask them to. If you understand what the chirps and mews actually are, those vocalizations don't talk to anybody outside of the group that those animals are in. So say you have four adult cows and four calves. All right, you got eight animals. If you hear chirps and mews going on, chirps and mews by definition are short, very short. They're just contact vocalizations. Those vocalizations are geared towards the individuals in that group, those eight individuals. So if there's a bull 200 yards away and those cows and calves are chirping and mewing between each other, they're not talking to the other elk out there. So it doesn't, it makes sense that it's, especially if you're going after a mature bull or a herd bull with cows, absolutely it makes sense that he didn't respond to you or the cows didn't respond to you. You didn't ask them to. Now, a younger age class bull might come smoking down the hill and come barreling in. Behaviorally, if it's a younger age class bull, especially a 2.5, maybe a 3.5 year old bull, well, they are still young enough where they need, behaviorally, they need a safety blanket. They want to be with cows and calves. And a lot of times they're the bulls that get run out of the harem that a dominant bull or more an older age class bull is going to be controlling. So they get pushed out. And so if they hear cows and calves talking and they don't hear a bull, behaviorally, from a social construct standpoint, they want the safety net of an adult cow and a calf group. They want that safety blanket. So they're going to run in just from a behavioral standpoint. But even if you're dealing with a 3.5 year old bull that says, hey, maybe I'm failing my oats and I want to breed. Again, they're a visual species. I talk about this all the time about it's sometimes in the best interest for an animal to make the move and make the first visual contact because they're a visual species. See you first, hear you second, smell you third. It's in their best interest to come running in there, make the first initial eye contact, and establish that communication with those animals. So yeah, you can have some of those bulls come running in, but again, you're not asking them to. You're not telling them anything. And so people get frustrated and say, well, I sound like a bunch of elk. Okay, what were you saying? Well, I was just chirps and mews. Okay, if you're going to do that, then you bet, you know, if you want to be successful on that, you're going to have to be very careful on where you set up and what the context of the visual imagery that you're portraying. So if you're setting up next to a feeding area during the typical time, either early morning or in the evening where maybe animals are going to be out there feeding, okay, well, that makes sense. But in that case, if all you're doing is doing chirps and mews, all you're doing is you're putting in their mind that, hey, there's a group of elk down there. But now you're leaving it up to the bull whether or not he wants to and it doesn't even matter whether we're talking about hunting bulls or for those people that say, I don't have a bull tag, I just have a cow tag, whether it's early season or late season, doesn't matter. The animal that you're trying to call, quote unquote, to, you're putting the decision-making process in their shoes or hooves, so to speak, and it's up to them whether they choose to want to be in that group or not. Sometimes they don't. So, you know, a lot of times these little behavioral things make a huge difference on, I mean, right off the get-go, predisposing whether you're setting yourself up for success or setting yourself up for failure.
This episode of the Hunt Backcountry podcast is brought to you by Hoyt Archery. Did you know that Hoyt, one of their standard tests that they do on all of their bow designs, is to intentionally dry fire their bow? Not just once, or twice, or a dozen times, but 1,500 times. The Hoyt Carbon Defiant that I'm shooting this year, that Steve's shooting this year, we've been shooting for a couple years, it's insane to think that it can take that abuse. 1,500 dry fires. Not only is the Carbon Defiant lighter than aluminum bows, it's also tougher. But their aluminum bows, they're strong too. They go through these dry fire tests as well. You guys go check out Hoyt.com/IAmDefiant. It gives you all kinds of information on why you should consider the Hoyt Defiant for your next bow purchase. Check them out. I'm curious, I want to move on to talk a little bit more about vocalizations, but before we do that, as we were talking about the doorway and things like that, if anything else sticks out to you in terms of being able to seal the deal in that last 100 to 150 yards, because I think so many guys, you know, they can locate elk. Maybe they can get to kind of in that range, 100 yards. But, I mean, as you know, I mean, that's where the battle is won, especially if you're archery hunting. And that's where shot opportunities are, you know, can be few and far between. And capitalizing and getting close and making that count is where you fill tags. So anything that comes to mind on advice or recommendations that guys should look into on sealing the deal in that last little bit of yardage there?
Well, then tell me what's the situation I'm dealing with. Am I dealing with a bull that has cows? Am I dealing with a bull that doesn't have cows, or do I not know? Am I in an early season scenario? I mean, see, that's – and I'm kind of needling you here, because that's the thing. A lot of times these little subtle things actually make big, big differences on the tactics and the approach that I take and the calling strategy that I take. So if I'm dealing with early season, and I'm literally just uploading a new video to our out module tonight on some vocalization stuff and building some more that should hopefully be released this week. Right now especially, I don't know if anybody's listening and you're headed to Colorado, you know that this year the archery season starts early. It starts August 26th. Anybody that's hunting Utah, goodness gracious, you're Utah seasons start early. So a lot of times you may be dealing with a situation where you don't have a bull with cows yet. Now, in some cases, those bulls may not even be interested in cows yet. Maybe they're interested in other bulls. If we're talking super, super early, like the Utah guys and some of our Colorado hunts, you know, especially in the high country, if you get up there and you're fine and those bulls are still in their bachelor groups, yes, cow calls may work for you, but if all of a sudden you get out there and you use cow calls and you're not getting the response that you think you should, don't hesitate to switch over to subtle. And again, we're not talking about challenge, you know, what people call challenge bugle, what I call dominant bugles, but we're not talking about challenging, but bull vocalizations. There's a pile of different bull vocalizations that you can use, subtle, that stimulate that curiosity and interest. You may find that early season, when the bulls are not with cows, they may actually respond better to other bull vocalizations in close than they actually will to cow vocalizations, because they're more interested in figuring out their pecking order. So contact bugles, whines, moans, even some huffs. You know, I call check bugles, where, you know, say a bull, he'll start to bugle, he'll start, he'll hesitate, kind of pause, stop, and then it just kind of fall off and just, it's almost like he changes his mind halfway through, where he's not quite sure if he wants to, you know, vocalize all the way. All those type of subtle things can work awesome on early season bulls that are still just either in their bachelor groups or just breaking up out of their bachelor groups. But likewise also, if those bulls are starting to split up and you think that, and all of a sudden you say you send out a lost mew and he responds, bam. All right. He's interested in the cow vocalization. All right. Great. For me, you know, I talk about all the time, and whether it's the website or our strategy app, you know, you've got passive strategies, targeted strategies, or aggressive strategies. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about bull vocalizations, or, you know, bugling or bull vocalizations, or whether we're talking about cow calling and cow vocalizations. You can be a passive, you can be targeted, or you can be aggressive. My moneymaker is always a targeted strategy. In a targeted strategy, we leave the realm of, you know, conversation that's just inside of, you know, the tight-knit little group that we're with. And now we're talking to animals outside of our group. We're talking to animals that we cannot see. We're talking to animals that we want a response from, or we want an action from. Lost mew asks for a response. What I call assembly mews, which flips at 180 degrees, that tells the animals, I want you to come to me. And so when you get, especially early season, if you stumble on a bull or you find a bull and he's interested in cow vocalizations, I never mess with a passive strategy. Just jump right in. Give him a lost mew, get a response, open that level of that line of communication. Make sure you can work your way in, like you said, about that 100, maybe 150 yards. And I'll do that with lost mews. I'm going to seek him out. I'm going to make that move. And we can talk. I mean, there's a lot to be talked about as far as a lost mew and what it means and what you're asking for. But as soon as I'm getting in with that 100 yards, 150 yards, I am going to flip that sucker around. I'm just going to start feeding him assembly mews and say, I want you to come to me, and I'm going to stay right here. And again, 90% of the time, they're going to just, and they may not bugle at you. They just might come in and mew at you. Just meh, meh. as he just kind of walks in and he's just going to sneak in and eat an arrow. So, yeah, I mean, I love the early season. And if I choose my own hunts, I always am out there the first 2 weeks of season because I really do enjoy catching those bulls before they get locked down with cows. And even for those folks that have a cow tag, if you have a cow tag, early season, appeal to that maternal instinct. If you use mature cow sounds constantly, don't be surprised to watch those cows turn around and walk away. Whether it's just themselves, them and their calf, or maybe it's a couple cows and their calves and they're by themselves and they walk away. Or really more importantly, and you see this all the time, or maybe you don't see it, you hear it. You've got a bull bugling, you cow call, he bugles at every single thing you give him, but he just seems to walk away. He just keeps drifting away further and further and further. People all the time are like, oh man, I must have done something, or he must have smelled me, or no. If he's responding to what you're saying, 90% of the time, he likes what you're giving him. He's interested in you. He's interested in your calling. He believes that you're a cow and he wants you to be with him. The problem is he probably has a couple cows and that cow's like, nope, I want no part of her. And she's going to leave. A lot of people focus on the bulls and their urge to breed. A lot of people overlook the fact that a cow has that same level of intensity on the need to breed. But unlike bulls, us guys, the more the merrier, the ladies, it's personal. Cows, she doesn't care if all the other cows on the mountain breed or not. Dang it, she is going to breed. And so a lot of times it's in her best interest to protect her bull that she's deemed worthy, that she has chosen to stay with. She's going to protect that bull, and she's going to protect her selfish interest in being bred when, as soon as she comes in into heat, when she cycles. And so she hears another adult cow sound, she's going to turn and walk away and pull that bull with her. However, they all have a very strong maternal instinct. Whether it's their calf or not, they are very drawn to making sure the young are taken care of. And so for those people that are hunting early season and they're dealing with a situation where a bull is locked down with cows, or if they have a cow tag and they're trying to call those cows in, lean heavy on the lost mews, the lost calf mews, those high-pitched lost calf sounds. That'll pay much, much better dividends than trying to sound like a mature cow.
Yeah. I'm curious, in the early season situations that you've been talking about, and potentially if the elk are more quiet on themselves, how are you initiating vocalizations if necessary to locate elk? Are you using location bugles? Are you doing cold calling setups with these lost mews? How are you getting this process started if you're not visually finding elk and they're being quiet in terms of their vocalizations early season?
All the above. You nailed it. And I don't mind people saying location bugles. I mean, that's pretty standard in the industry today. You'll hear me, if you take a look at my stuff, it'll always be a contact bugle. Because the thing is, those same vocalizations, those high-pitched, just those high-pitched, high whistly. Now, we're not talking about the growly, the gravelly, what people say challenge bugles or, dominant bugles. We're talking about those contact or location type bugles. Those vocalizations can be used for many more reasons than just locating. So I always call it a contact bugle. But absolutely, if I'm going to start out, a lot of times, if I am in an area that I'm familiar with, so I am familiar with where the elk usually are, I am familiar with where the elk typically feed, that type of deal. A lot of times I'll try to get into camp a couple days early and just kind of really, just sit on a ridge and just listen. Or if I'm in the high country, I can sit on a ridge or sit on a point and I can glass and I can watch. If I can glass and I can watch, then I will absolutely, I'll spend a couple days if necessary, just never even dropping down in after them. I'll just sit and watch and pattern. Just what is their routine? Where are they coming out of the timber? When are they going back in? Where are they getting water? Where are they bedding? Where are they feeding? How many are out there? who comes out first? Are they coming out together? Are there lollygaggers? Is the bull? I mean, I just eat all of that up, and I'll sit for a couple days and just sit and watch, figuring out where the vulnerabilities are, and then I'll pick my game plan from there, and then I'll slip in and work them. However, if I am in lower elevation country, maybe it's all timbered, and where I'm going this year, I have a very limited ability to get on any sort of point in glass. I mean, I can get on points, but it's just so thick that the pines and the brush is so thick that it doesn't matter. I mean, they're just going to be buried in there. At that point, because there's a couple places I am familiar with, I'm just going to go to those places where I know, okay, they typically used to feed here, or they typically used to bed here. They typically traveled between their bedding area and their feeding area here. If that's the case, then typically what I will do is I will slip in. I always try to start with a cow call. I'll just start with a lost mule. One of the things that folks will learn about me if they're not familiar with me already is I really do lean heavy on the philosophy of start low key and then build up from there. I don't mind calling a lot if I need to, but I never call more than I need to, but I will call as much as I have to. And so I will slip in and I'll just give them a lost mew or two and just send that out there and just see if I can get a response. If I do, then a lost mew is very, very low key. And that also means a lost mew can be directed at a bull. It can be directed at a calf. It can be directed at another cow. So if I send out a lost mew, it's a very realistic vocalization to be cast across the landscape. But if a bull bugles at it, I know right then and there, dude, he's interested in cows. Bam. He just responded. Okay. Well, I'm going to feed him cow calls. But if I send out a lost mew, get no response. Send out a few more, no response. I'm going to give it a few minutes. I mean, and depending on the day, you know, it's one of those days where the squirrels are running around, birds are singing, you know, everything's alive. Then maybe I don't wait that long. Other days where, you know, you don't even want to step on wet grass because it's so quiet. Maybe I'll wait 15 minutes. Maybe I'll wait 30 minutes. And then I'll switch over to a contact bugle. Another thing that I try to do is I'll separate things out into level one, level two, level three. And all that is a differentiation on how intense am I calling. So level one, very, very low key. Level two, moderate intensity. Level three, I'm going aggressive. Okay. So I might just start out with just a level one contact bugle, just send that out there and just let it hang and just let it soak. Just see what response I get. I'll let it sit for several minutes. If I don't get a response, I'll step up and maybe do a level two where I'll add a little bit more intensity to that vocalization saying, hey, I'm looking for a response. Dang it, somebody give me a response. I'll let that soak. If nothing responds, I'll step it up to maybe a more aggressive contact bugle, maybe add some chuckles in there, say, hey, dang it, I really want a response. Someone respond to me. If I don't get anything, at that point, I'm moving. I'm going to move. I'm going to move up the ridge. I'm going to move down the valley. I'm going to move to the other side of the bowl, whatever. I'm going to move. And the reason why I'm going to move is because if you think about an elk, if an elk is out there seeking a response from someone else, they're not going to just stand like a stone in one spot on the edge of that meadow and call for the next hour. Not if they're seeking a response. Now, if we're talking about, I want to simulate a cow and a calf or a group of cows and a calf just feeding there, that's completely different. That's a passive strategy, completely different. But if I'm trying to locate animals, prospect, I'm going to cover country, I'm going to move, I'm going to be just like an elk is going to be, and they're going to move, they're going to seek, they're going to travel across the landscape until they make contact with another animal. Now, the one thing we don't have is a nose that can pick up. But yeah, if we're really close to another group of animals, we'll smell them. But, you know, the beautiful thing with elk, I mean, they can pick up the subtle things. And so sometimes they'll just scent trail another group into another area. But most of the time, I'm going to use a lost mew to start, really passive, or just really low key. I will step up from there if I need to, and I'll maybe move to bugles. And then I'll move. Now, if a bull bugles, say I start out with lost mews, get nothing. And then all of a sudden I give him a contact bugle and bam, he responds. Okay, now I know. A, I started the conversation. B, he was more interested in this other bull that he didn't know was out there, you know, the strange bull that's out there on the landscape, than he was a cow. So from there on, I very well may lean heavy on the bull vocalizations as I continue to move in. But I always leave myself room to accelerate or increase the intensity or the aggressiveness of my calling. I always start low and then build high if I need to.
Yeah, that's a great breakdown. Can we go back to something you mentioned earlier about transitioning from that lost mew to more of the assembly mew once you close the distance and you're trying to then call the elk into you? Can you talk a bit about the differences in the characteristics of those vocalizations?
Yeah, most people know what a lost mew. Well, I apologize. I assume you probably have a bunch of beginner hunters that are your fan base as well. So
yeah, we have everybody. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So I apologize for jumping in. So a lost mew. You'll hear people talk about lost mew all the time, and typically a lost mew is going to hold the high note. So yeah. Yeah, so high and then drop off kind of quickly at the end. The beautiful thing about a lost mew, if you really become a student of elk and their vocalizations, you'll hear lost mews delivered, well, I guess four ways. Two different ways, two different styles. So, meaning a cow can give a lost mew either with her mouth open, or she can give a lost mew with her mouth closed, sending all the sound out through her nasal cavity. Okay, that's going to change the tonal signature of that call. All right, one's going to be louder, one's going to be softer, but there's going to be a nasally little tonal difference. Likewise, however, a lost mew can be delivered where it just holds the high note and then just drops off quickly to the low note. Yeah. Or, especially with calves, you'll hear this all the time, where they will just punch or emphasize the high note and then fall off quickly at the end. Meow! Meow! Okay? So understanding that, you can be a little bit more realistic in your calling. You'd be a little bit more diverse in your calling. So you can either hold it or you can punch it. But regardless, both of those hold or emphasize the high note of the vocalization. That's asking for a response. Right, an assembly mew is generally done by a mature cow, oftentimes the dominant cow in the group. Now, if it's a cow talking with her calf, obviously, mom talking to her child, I want you to come to me. She's going to use an assembly mew. But if an assembly mew is given across the landscape from a dominant cow, she can do that for, you know, a dominant lead cow will do that for the rest of the group. Hey, guys, I want you to come to me. Flip that call 180 degrees. So it's just the opposite. Short on the high note, long, drawn out, low note. Yeah. Okay? And it can be a variety of pitches. It can be a variety of lengths and how long that draws out. For me, by far, to this date, there is no other call or call manufacturer that has perfected the ability for a hunter to emulate the assembly mew than the Primos Hyperlip double with the tone converter attached. You do an assembly mew with a Primos Hyperlip double with a tone converter attached, you will flat nail it. Nail it. But that assembly mew says, it's not asking for a response now. It's saying, I want you to come to me. I don't care if you respond to me. I don't care if you vocalize at me. I don't care what you do. I don't care if you skip. I don't care if you twirl. I don't care if you roll. I don't care how you get here. I want you to come to me. Mothers will do that to the calves all year long. They will do it to their yearling bulls, but more importantly, they will do it to the rest of the group. And goodness gracious, it works great for bulls that are separated on their own. Every single animal on that landscape used to be a calf. Every single animal on that landscape has been talked to and given the assembly mew and told, I want you to come to me, your mother. and that every single animal on that landscape darn well knows what that vocalization means. And especially for those people that just want to fill the freezer, they do not care if it's a 2.5-year-old or 3.5-year-old satellite bull. Oh, it's money. You slip in, you get close and say, I want you to come to me. Most of the time, it's a yes, ma'am, I'm on my way.
Yeah, done. I'm glad you highlighted the fact that they don't necessarily come in a certain way. Like, so the scenario you laid out earlier of this lost mew, potentially you might have a bull responding to that, maybe with a bugle. But if you then transition to this assembly mew, and the bull then shuts up, as hunters, we might think, oh, well, something's wrong. Oh, he blew out. Oh, whatever. I should try something else, etc. But it sounds like that's a position where you just need to maybe exercise some patience because that bull is fully committed. I mean, he's coming in, but he stopped being vocal in response because he said, oh, they're calling. I'll come. I don't need to talk anymore, right? Because I'm coming. So that's good to know that as hunters, if we make that transition and go assembly mew, to wait it out, don't give up if we're not, receiving more vocalizations from that.
And the other thing too, you nailed it. Absolutely. And if folks get on my website in the Elk module, you're going to see, like I said, you've got the foundation principles, and there's a series of videos in there that are just the basic, okay, here's your nuts and bolts. Here's the information that from which everything else builds. Okay, hence the foundation. And then you go to recognition. Recognition for us, we got the gallery and we've got a series called Real Elk Sounds where people get to watch elk be elk on their own without any outside interference. So you get to see cows interact with their calves. You see bulls interact with their harems. You get to see bulls interact with the bulls. Okay, this is not a hunting scenario.
Do you provide commentary on that?
Oh, yeah.
Like context on what's happening? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Not only in the beginning of the video, it will set up, I'll say, setting the stage, what are you looking at? It goes through all of it. I set the stage, what you're going to see, why it's important, viewing, listening tips. Okay, pay attention to this, pay attention to that, listen with headphones so you can hear the subtle stuff. I set all that up in the beginning. And then on some, especially at the beginning recognition, the gallery videos, on screen, I will put, a cow will, okay, and I'll label it, lost mew. She'll do it as meow, assembly mew, whine, frustrated whine, selfish mew. What I will label the vocalization so people can hear it, see what it is, and they can, so they've already gone through the foundation, they've got the nuts and bolts, they've got the meat and potatoes, now they can see it in action, they can see it on the cows or the bulls, they can see it play out in real time with the animals themselves. Once you get to be able to recognize it, then we have the application portion where we have the Elk Hunters Strategy app, not only the app functioning tool, but also the strategies in action video series where we say, okay, let's take the foundation. Let's take what you've recognized and you've learned in the gallery in Real Elk Sounds. Now let's go out in the field. We found a bull. We found some cows. Here's where we are. Here's the situation. Here's what's going on. I'm going to use this strategy because of this reason. I'm going to set up here because of this. I'm going to use these vocalizations, and you get to sit there and watch me do everything that I teach you, and you get to see an animal literally be called in. So absolutely, when in that strategies in action series, that is one of the things that I always point out. There are some videos where it's literally 6 minutes. Like I'm thinking of one right now. I call it 108. It's a bull that was ear tagged as part of a movement study in this particular area. He's got an ear tag in his ear. It's number 108. Literally, from when I set the camera down and I make my first vocalization to the point he's standing 7 steps in front of the camera is 6 minutes. That's it. It's right now. Whereas I have other strategies in action videos that are literally 55 over an hour. And I let the thing run in real time because what you just talked about is so important. I let these videos run in real time so people get to understand how much time did I actually wait between when I called and when I maybe I moved a little bit more, or maybe I called again. And in that dead zone, sometimes I'll put in there, okay, I'm still waiting because of XYZ, or do not move yet because you just heard this bull mew. And a lot of times, like you said, with an assembly mew, you're not asking for a response. You're asking for an action. So you don't have to don't expect a bull to respond or a cow to respond. Now, if they do, a lot of times, and I guarantee most people that have been in front of elk before and have called elk before have heard that typical bull mew, that flat meh. It doesn't fall off as much as a cow mew does. It's just this more meh, meh. You'll hear that, and it's subtle. You can hear it from 80 to 100 yards away. But if you do it, if you hear that, that bull is interested, and 90 out of 100 times that bull is on his way. Do not move. I sit there and I can show you through the strategies and action videos. I'm looking at the bull through the timber, and he's standing like a stone for 15 minutes. His ears are forward. He's looking in my direction. He knows darn well where I am. He knows darn well he should be able to see something. He's just going to stand there and he's going to wait. One of the things I talk about is, if we're talking about especially cow vocalizations, again, cows don't vocalize unless they're up on their feet and doing something. There's a whole series of reasons why a cow is going to vocalize. If you're vocalizing and you're sounding like a, especially if you're going to, it doesn't matter if you're going to sound like a cow or if you're going to sound like a bull, that means you're an elk, you're up on your feet, and you're doing something. If you're up on your feet and you're doing something, there should be movement, and you're a big animal. So a lot of times those bulls will stand out there off in the distance, and their ears are literally, I mean, anybody that's done audio work knows you just crank the gain. Gain just increases the volume on everything, just brings out every little sound that they get. Their ears are just cranked, picking up every subtle sound that they can possibly pick up, and they'll just stand there. And it might be 10, 15, 20 minutes, and then all of a sudden you're there like, all right, well, nah, I'm going to move for it, and here they come. They continue on their way. Just because you don't get a response does not mean they're not coming, number one. Number two, just because you don't get a response, even if they're not coming, doesn't mean they're not standing there watching. And I think the a huge reason, and I'm sure there's a pile of people out there listening to this right now that say, I was calling, the bull was bugling, all of a sudden he shut up and he just nothing. I took two steps and all of a sudden the whole world just exploded. The bulls just took off and the elk just took. Yeah, because they were just out of sight. They were standing there. And they were just watching. If you had had a little more patience, let things play out, a lot of times they will sucker in, or they're going to say something. Most of the time, if I think a bull is there and I think he was responding, before I ever move or change position or change tactics or anything, I will shut up until I hear him vocalize, or I'm going to stop. I'm just going to back out. I'm going to go several hundred yards. And I'm going to do a big, huge button hook loop, reposition on the landscape, and then I'll try. I'm not going to go forward because I can tell you right now, I can show you way too many times in the strategies and actions videos, those animals are just standing there watching and waiting.
Yeah, I think that's a tough situation for most hunters, you know, because I mean, when the action's there and then dies down, it's like, do I be patient? How long do I be patient? Do I move? Don't I move? Do I call? Don't I call? I mean, we've all, if you've hunted elk, you've been there. And it's always a tough situation.
And absolutely. And the thing is, you know, and I use this term loosely, you know, the kind of the celebrities, you know, what it doesn't matter who's talking about elk calling and this type of stuff. Some of us, I am very fortunate, okay? This is part of my business, and I have a very understanding wife that is very capable of handling all of our other business. At this point in my life, for what I'm doing, I essentially take the entire month of September off, and well, it's not off. I mean, it's for me, the elk module is my job, but I'm out in the field for a full month. Okay, end of August all the way to the end of September, and sometimes into the beginning of October as well. Obviously, not everybody can do that. And when I first started elk hunting, I was a college student. I was holding down three jobs to pay for school. That was on top of already having the Army College Fund and GI Bill. So, I mean, essentially, I was working my brains off trying to pay for college. And me and my buddy literally had weekends. We would leave campus on a Friday evening after classes. We would drive to our elk spot. We would hike in the dark. We would get into camp anywhere between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m., set up camp, get up Saturday morning, hunt Saturday morning, Saturday evening. If we didn't get something on the ground by then, we would complain and grumble, and then we would get up early Sunday morning and decide. We're like, all right, do we try to go Sunday? Because we have to leave Sunday night. So if we kill something Sunday morning, we've got to get that whole thing out to the truck so we can get back in the truck and be back on campus by late Sunday night so we can be back in class Monday morning. So you've got like a day, if not maybe a day and a half. So you got a day and a half weekend to make it happen, and you're sitting there saying, okay, I heard a bull, maybe give it a couple hours and don't move. What? No, you know, we've been waiting all year for this. We've waited 51 weeks. This is opening weekend. I want to make this happen. So, you know, we do. We let our eagerness, and I say desperation, not in a disrespectful manner. I mean, because that is, you feel desperate. You're like, I've got to make this happen. Well, sometimes the best thing that you can do, and I again, this is another thing I talk about. You're never going to make an elk do anything. You're not, except maybe run away. Yeah, I can make an elk run away. That's not a problem.
I'm good at that. Exactly. I mean, it's a gift.
Exactly. If you're like me, let me segue real quick. You know how there's some people, and I'm one of them, you have a campfire, and you set a campfire, and there's going to be one person around that campfire ring that the smoke always blows right to? That's me. I'm going to suck smoke the entire time we have a campfire. It doesn't matter where I sit. The wind is going to switch, and the smoke is going to just choke me out. Well, I am one of those people, the same thing. I find an elk, I start moving in, I get close, and I cannot tell you. If people watch, I've got a YouTube channel, and there's a video in there of me killing a really nice 5x6. And the one joke that some of the commenters were, I was fighting the wind. They don't have an understanding of how frustrating it is for me, because I am cursed when it comes to wind direction. And it is always at the most inopportune time is always going to switch. It's always going to switch and blow right at them. So yeah, but trust me, I can make animals run away, but we're never going to make them do anything else favorable. All we can do is put in their mind what they ought to do, or maybe what's in their best interest to do at the time. All we can do is suggest to them, hey, this is a scenario that might be appealing to you, whether that's a cow appealing to her maternal instinct, whether it's a younger bull, appealing to that safety blanket, or a younger bull appealing to the fact that maybe I'm a satellite bull and I can score on a lone cow and a calf and get my own ladies, whether we're talking about a herd bull, whatever, it doesn't matter. All we can do is suggest to them what we think they ought to do, or maybe it's in their best interest, and then it's up to them. And so if we think we are on a tight timeline, man, can it be tough to sit back and just take a breath and go, okay, I've done my job. I've located them. I know where they are, and I've opened up that dialogue. They're responding to me. Awesome. I have moved in. I've covered the ground. I've gotten close. I'm within that 100, 150 yards. I've done that well. I've vocalized in such a way that I've told them exactly what I want them to think. At that point, you've done your job. Now it's up to them. You've intrigued their behavior, their curiosity. You've put a picture in their brain. You've got to trust that what you just did is enough. Now, you might have to adjust here later on, but let, and I talk about this, this is another, let the setup work. Let it work. So many times, they just take their time. And they might just come slowly feeding in. That's fine. They'll eat an arrow just as well, whether they're feeding or whether they're coming in, charging in, bugling at me. I don't care. I don't care. Mm-hmm. The meat, I've got an elk on the ground and I've got a freezer full of meat. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's great. One more thing. I'm sure we could talk for hours, and thankfully it sounds like we have hours and hours of content that are accessible from you. But one more thing I just want to make sure we hit, and you mentioned it, that elk, especially cows, they're going to be vocalizing from their feet. They're going to be moving. Obviously, any elk moving is making noise. I'm curious how you integrate non-elk vocalization noises into your approach, whether that's something like raking or just natural, you know, footsteps, just kind of the natural commotion of elk, or something specific like raking. When do you turn to that? How do you integrate it into your approach?
For me, again, it all goes back to my initial philosophy as trying to start low key and always building up from there. If you think about elk moving across a landscape, yes, we all know there are times when, goodness gracious, it's like somebody has a D9 cat just driving through the timber. I mean, it just, they're loud. But that's typically not the norm. More often than not, at least for where I hunt public land, over-the-counter units. Every now and then I'll be able to draw a limited entry license and have, you know, an opportunity at that. But year in and year out, I'm on public ground. I'm out there slugging it out with all the other guys and gals out there hunting. Most of the elk that I encounter, more often than not, I'm looking up going, holy, where the heck did they just come from? They just slip in and they're dead silent. So as I'm moving across the landscape, whether I'm calling or not, most of the time I'm going to try to be as absolute dead silent as possible. Now, obviously, if depending on what scenario I'm trying to portray, if I want to involve a, say, for instance, a cow calling strategy, and I want to be more aggressive with that, all right, well, if I'm going to be moving, I'm going to be moving quickly, I'm going to be vocalizing a lot, well, if you think about it from a cow's standpoint or an elk standpoint, if she is moving quickly, if she is vocalizing loudly, then she at that moment is not as concerned for safety as she is for accomplishing whatever it is she's trying to do, whether she's trying to locate other animals, whether she's trying to get her calf to come in, whether she's trying to get a bull to respond, whatever. Whatever she's doing that's causing her to move quickly and vocalize loudly is dominating her decision-making process, and sound moving across the landscape is probably not as important. So that's usually when you'll hear those animals moving quickly and usually a little bit more loudly. So when I move into a more aggressive cow calling strategy, that's when I will purposely kick rocks, step on twigs, snap twigs as I'm walking by. I will start making secondary sounds, you know, environmental sounds to make it sound like an actual animal is moving across the landscape. Same thing with my bull vocalizations, just like you said. I'm going to start out low-key. I'm going to use my bull vocalizations just like a bull will. Typically, he's going to be very quiet. But as I bump up the intensity, or if I'm in a situation where I am in that zone, I'm in within 100 yards, that bull is there, he's engaging me, we're going back and forth, he's just reluctant, okay, well, then I'm going to use some of those sounds like you just said with raking, or whether I'm going to start moving around and snapping branches and make it sound like I'm doing something in that area other than vocalizing. The beautiful thing about raking is it can actually portray a number of different, it can be done for a number of different reasons. You know, some people think it's an aggressive sound, which it can actually be, depending on how aggressive you rake. The other thing it can do is, or it can be done, and the reason why it is done by an elk is from a behavior standpoint, it's called displacement behavior. So if an animal gets frustrated, or he feels that he can't get the response or the action or reaction from the other animal that he's looking for, or he feels intimidated, especially, he's going to take his frustrations out on another inanimate object. And so he can start raking his antlers just out of frustration. It's not an aggression thing. It's just a frustration and a displacement behavior. Well, that can be absolutely ideal for getting another bull to sucker in, because now you're saying you're frustrated, you're nervous, you're not confident enough to come all the way to the bull that is, you know, the real bull that's on the landscape. So you're going to take your frustrations out on this harmless inanimate tree. You know, that type of sound can absolutely be dynamite, but it's always in a progression. I start low, and then if I need to add those things to add the realism, add the intensity to my setup, that's when I add them.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, that approach is so straightforward. I think it's helpful to keep in mind, especially as many of us hunters have heard different techniques, different approaches. But
yeah,
I mean, just thinking logically about this progression, keeping that in mind and not just jumping from, you know, these wild swings of being super aggressive and then trying some other crazy technique, but to be much more methodical about it just overall, I think is gonna help a lot of folks.
Well, and I will be the first to admit, I mean, I know you guys do a lot of work with Corey, and I've got a lot of respect for Corey. You know, Corey and I kind of do have, when we're talking about tactics, I don't think Corey and I disagree at all. But when we're talking about philosophy a little bit, I think we do, and which is fine. It's just fine. One of the videos I've got on my YouTube channel is, and it's more controversial and it's more popular. Take it for what it is. It's the mastering your vocalizations, you know, or mastering your calling, you know, does it really matter? Does it matter if you know what you're saying? In there, I give an example of, you know, say you're in a valley and there are 10 bulls in that valley. There are some people that, you know, and respectfully, I think Corey is one of them. He's said this on numerous podcasts, probably even yours, where he really does enjoy that more aggressive bugling strategy. He wants to find that bull that wants to play his game, that is going to aggressively respond to bugling and bull vocalizations. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's awesome. Absolutely. That's the sexy side of elk calling. My philosophy is, if there's 10 bulls in that valley, okay, I want to know how to approach and work all 10 bulls. There are going to be some that are lovers, some that are fighters. There are going to be some that are timid. There are going to be some that are aggressive. There are going to be some that want to bugle and want to challenge and fight. And then there's going to be some that are going to stand there and they're going to wait until they actually see an elk before they even do anything. My teaching philosophy, my personal hunting philosophy is, I would like to have the toolbox full of tools and knowledge to allow me to go into that valley and work all 10 of those bulls however they need to be worked. And again, it doesn't matter if we're talking about bulls. I use bulls because that's what most people are going after. But it's the same thing for cow hunters. Whether it's early season or late season, it doesn't matter. I want to go into that valley and work every animal I encounter however that particular animal wants to work.
Yeah, whatever's going to get the job done, right?
Yeah, you know, and there's some people that want a more aggressive, you know, they want to find that one bull that wants to play their game and be a little more aggressive, and that's fine. The reason why I think for me, it's my philosophy has worked so well, is in a lot of the places that I have hunted and over-counter units and heavily pressured areas, I may not find a bull that actually wants to play that aggressive game. Way too often, I'm finding those bulls that are just tight-lipped, that are timid, they don't want to engage, they're very cautious. So by starting low key and building up if I need to, it has helped me engage a lot more animals on the landscape than I think if I just dove into an aggressive strategy. If you dive into an aggressive strategy, you don't really leave yourself any room. There's nowhere to go. You know, most of the time, you're not going to be able to take a step back very effectively. However, if you start low and then build if you need to, you've always got a place to go before you end up moving on. So it's just a different philosophy. And for those people that share that philosophy, I think the Elk Module Rolling Resources is good for them. And especially if you're the type of person that, you know, if the question why is always nagging you, you know, why does an elk do that? Why does a cow do that? Why does the bull do that? Why did he do that? Why did he come in that? Why did he come over? If you are the type of person just needles you. You just want to know why. That's what the elk module, and that's what we're about. That's what I love to do. That's my passion, and I do it from a scientific standpoint.
Yeah, that's a great way to wrap it up. Where can we point the listeners to learn more about the elk hunting module and everything that you do have to offer?
Sure, just roehuntingresources.com. It's just ROE. roehuntingresources.com, and that's our website. It's everything's video based, so it's online streaming, it's all mobile ready, and we've got at this point now more than 25 hours of video for you to watch. There's some that's just strictly instructional, and then there's a pile that's just elk. If you want to practice your cow vocalizations, you want to practice your bugling, go to the gallery. We've hours of elk just vocalizing point blank in front of the camera, so you can practice all that and see it. So yeah, go to the elk module. Just hit click sign up. It's $25 for 3 months or $50 for a full year. But you can also find us on the social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, just Roe Hunting Resources, YouTube. We've got a whole pile of stuff. Yeah, it's anywhere they look, they can find us.
Perfect. Chris, thank you so much for sharing your time and knowledge with us.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me on.
Guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode. As you heard, be sure to check out everything that Chris has to offer over at roehuntingresources.com. Next week, we're going to have another elk episode from a super fun guest, one of the guests that we've had requested to come back on the show and join us. That's Paul the Elk Nut Medel. It's always a good time not only hearing Paul's passion, but learning from his decades of experience and knowledge. So be sure to tune in for that one. As always, thank you guys so much for listening. If you're headed out this weekend, good luck scouting or hunting or just enjoying the outdoors. Get out there and get after it.